Welcome to UK Health Radio. You are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show, hosted by Shamina Rabi, a consultant speech and language therapist and founder of Unlocking Language, an award-winning independent practice that provides speech and language therapy to both adults and children. She is dedicated to raising awareness about speech, language, communication and swallowing difficulties and empowering those who have them.
Welcome to UK Health Radio, your global good feel radio, and you are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show. This is Shamina, and I hope you're all well. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about sensory feeding difficulties in autism. As I mentioned, throughout the month of December, we are going to be covering different topics around autism. And today we have a fantastic speech and language therapist with us called Sarah, who works with children who have dysphagia or feeding, swallowing difficulties in combination or as a result with their autism. So I'm sure many of us can relate to the challenges of trying to feed picky eaters, yet this is not uncommon and is often resolved with time. However, children on the autism spectrum may be more restrictive in their food choices than what is typical, and this selectively may extend beyond the early childhood years, presenting challenges for families, including distressing mealtimes. Food selectivity in children with autism spectrum disorders can be affected by both behavioural and environmental problems. And one of the consistent themes relates to food textures, how foods look, how they feel or smell. And these can be common sensory factors for individuals with autism. The temperature, texture needs to be just right or have perfect uniformity. Needless to say, this can be taxing at times. Yet children with autism can be reasonably healthy eaters and enjoy a wide range of foods. So today we'll be exploring more of the strategies that can be done at home to address eating and feeding problems, to lead to more pleasant mealtime routines, sort of red flags that you can be looking out for if you're working in the education system or are a parent with a child with autism or querying autism. And we'll have lots of sort of discussion around sensory feeding difficulties with the therapist coming to join us for today's session. Okay, so today on the show, we have specialist speech and language therapist, Sarah Watkins-Baker. Sarah graduated from the University of Cape Town in South Africa with a distinction in a Bachelor of Science degree in speech and language pathology. Her experience comes from multiple settings in both private and government sectors, which includes hospitals, schools, clinics, and working with both adults and children with a range of speech, language, communication, and swallowing difficulties and disorders. She's developed a particular interest in children with swallowing and feeding difficulties and previously worked with neonates and children with feeding difficulties within the acute setting. Sarah is currently in mainstream primary and secondary schools, as well as running a clinic with early years and complex needs. Since working in the UK, she has attended the SOS Approach to Feeding training and is now a level one basic provider. And she has been working with children with sensory feeding difficulties in the clinic, as well as starting to support children, again, with feeding difficulties in the school setting. So welcome, Sarah, to the Speech and Language Therapy Show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
It's great to have you here. And as I was saying to you earlier, that this month in December, each week, we are dedicating a topic related to autism and children on the autistic on the autistic spectrum disorder. This month, we are dedicating our shows to speech and language, communication and swallowing difficulties in relation to autism. Okay, so that's a very, very interesting and very impressive CV. So tell me, how did you get into pediatric dysphagia?
Well, I think back home in South Africa, it kind of works a bit differently. You trained in both pediatric and adult dysphagia.
Okay.
And basically after we graduate, we do a year where we work in a government setting for the government, kind of a way of, you know, giving back and providing a service.
Okay.
So basically I was placed in a hospital in quite a rural town in South Africa, and I worked with pretty much everything and anything that came my way. Mm-hmm. So I worked with both children and adults, and I did have quite a few cases with children with feeding and swallowing difficulties, and also worked with neonates that had some feeding difficulties and kind of helping, supporting them and getting them back onto breastfeeding.
And when you say neonates, what age are we talking about?
So usually most of them were premature babies, or just babies that had specific feeding difficulties, like they couldn't suck or things like that. So we would, as a speech therapist, would go in and kind of assess them and help the moms feed them in the best way that they can. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into it. We did a few blocks at university,
okay,
but my actual working experience started there with working with children with feeding difficulties, and I think that's really where the interest kind of started and grew.
And it's vast, isn't it, pediatric dysphagia? I mean, you can work with, as you said, neonates all the way up to young people at 16.
Exactly.
And with different medical conditions such as Down syndrome or cerebral palsy, so having an organic swallow difficulty as well as something sensory related.
Exactly. So there are a range of feeding and swallowing difficulties that, you know, will present in children. As we said, whether this will be an organic problem where, you know, their swallow safety is effective and there's maybe a structural reason for that, or it just might be sensory related, like a food aversion. So it is quite a range, and every child kind of presents differently. So, yeah.
Okay, so just so that our listeners know, today we will be talking about sensory difficulties or sensory feeding difficulties. Yeah. Is that the term that's used?
Yeah, generally that's the term that we would use.
So what does that mean? What are sensory feeding difficulties?
So these are just feeding difficulties that are related to sensory issues. So feeding is a very complicated task. So generally we think of it as quite simple. In fact, we don't think much about it when we eat something and swallow something. It's fairly automatic. But it is actually a learned behavior, and it actually is extremely complicated. I'm sure you're working with adults, you understand.
Absolutely.
So it involves all our organ systems and involves all our senses as well as our muscles. So kind of when the sensory aspect of that is effective, it can have an impact on eating or feeding. And some children that have sensory issues or like a sensory processing disorder, they can be either hypersensitive or hyposensitive. And basically, if you're hypersensitive, it means you overreact to certain stimuli, and if you hypo, you underreact.
Okay.
And both these things can impact on eating and feeding and make it difficult. Also, if a child is not regulated, they are likely to have feeding difficulties. So regulated means that they're able to manage and cope with their senses, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're regulated, they're able to focus on what's in front of them, they're able to focus on eating and kind of the process of eating, and then they're able to eat well. But if they are dysregulated, and even if they have the oral motor skills, they might still have those difficulties with feeding.
And so you briefly touched on hypo and hypersensitivity.
Yeah.
What does that look like when a child has got feeding problems?
So let's start with hypersensitive or hypersensitivity, because this is something that you can very clearly see in children. So if you had to, it kind of depends which senses are affected. So if a child is visually overreactive to stimuli, then you'll very clearly see that. So he might avoid eye contact, he might try to push it away, or have, you know, a complete meltdown because he's completely visually overstimulated by whatever food's in front of him. Just like if you have tactile issues, these children aren't going to like textures. You're going to see things like finger splaying if they accidentally touch something, for example, that's moist or wet.
Okay.
You're going to see them immediately.
And they dislike that.
Or they're going to push it away.
Okay.
So those are the kind of things that you might notice. If a child's under-responsive, good examples with taste, for example, they might take a lot to kind of alert them. So, for example, they might really like really spicy or sour foods, and that's kind of the only thing that gets them aroused or something like that. So those are kind of, and it's the same with, you know, movement. These children that are under-responsive might. So children who are under-responsive, as I said, it might take a lot to kind of alert them and get them going.
Okay.
So you might have to do lots of like movement-based activities. So those are kind of those children. They're kind of understimulated.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So I usually leave questions from our listeners till the end of the show, but I'm going to change it slightly because I feel it will help us with the direction of our conversation. So a mum has called in and, well, not called in, written in, and said that her child, who has a diagnosis of autism, is 4 years old, but eats one particular food all the time. Actually, he just likes fish fingers, so he wants fish finger sandwich or fish fingers for lunch, fish fingers for dinner. And that's quite difficult because he's at school now, even for breakfast. What is that? What is it when a child wants to just eat one type of food all the time?
So that is something that we call a food jag.
Okay, food jag.
Yeah, and it's generally when a child eats the same food over and over and over again. So it also can be they like that food prepared in the same way.
Okay.
So maybe it's the same shape or it's cooked in the exact same way. Basically, they like that food presented that way over and over again. And a lot of children, even typically developing children, might, you know, go through this, and I'm sure, I don't know if you've had any examples with your kids.
Absolutely, they get stuck on wanting to eat just chicken nuggets.
Exactly.
Or the same packet of crisps again and again and again.
Yeah.
Not that I give them crisps all the time. but yeah, they do latch onto something that they really enjoy.
Exactly. So it is something that children do kind of sometimes go through. But kind of when we become concerned is that they may eventually get bored or burn out with this food. And then this kind of becomes the problem where they could possibly completely eliminate that food from the range of foods that they eat. And this can be quite limiting. So some children will be fine and they will take a break from that food and they will be able to come back and start eating that food again.
Okay.
But with some children, they might completely eliminate this and they won't eat it again, or it might take an extremely long time.
So what can this mum do who is saying that at the moment all he wants is fish fingers?
So with food jags, one of the recommendations that, or what parents can do at home, is offer the preferred foods, so the foods that the child really likes, every other day.
Okay.
So you're kind of changing it up so they're not having the same foods every single day. You're offering it every other day. Also, if it's quite or difficult or really this is like the only food that the child will eat, you kind of want to start making very small changes to that food, maybe the shape, the color, the texture.
So to the fish fingers.
Yeah, exactly. To kind of create that variation and kind of almost like weaning them off that food or trying to change it in a way so they accept it, and then hopefully you can start introducing other foods.
But would that not cause meltdowns and tantrums?
Yeah, it may. So I think if it is a really, you know, big problem for the, you know, family and the child, we just want to make the slightest of changes. So initially it might be so small that, you know, the child will be able to tolerate it. And we kind of build on from there. And then as the child accepts the changes that are being made to the food, hopefully we can make more and more changes until eventually they're not food jagging on that food anymore and we can introduce other foods.
And typically how long could that take?
varies. I think it's just dependent on the child.
Is it treatable? I mean, is it manageable?
Yeah, there are ways to manage it.
Okay.
And it might take a while. So I think, you know, as parents, as stressful as it is, you know, we've got to kind of hang in there and just keep going. And some children, it might not be that big a problem. It might take quite quick to resolve. Other children might take longer. It kind of just is dependent on the child.
Great. Okay, thanks. So we had another question that was emailed a couple of days ago. This is from Dad. He's saying that he has a 26-month-old, so a child has just turned two, just slightly over two, and his child is a boy, not diagnosed yet, but feels that the child may be on the spectrum, but the child is only having purees, and he's not been able to move him on to even softer foods or solids. Again, is that sort of typical of a sensory feeding problem?
It may be. So it might be that the child, as I said before, that they have an aversion to textures. So maybe that's, he likes his food in that puree consistency. It's smooth. It doesn't have any bumps. And, you know, textures he just might completely avoid because he does have a sensory aversion. The other thing with purees is it is easy to eat. If you kind of think about how we would eat a yogurt,
Don't really need to chew.
Yeah, it's fairly simple. There's no chewing. Whereas when we move on to more solid foods, it's a little bit more complex and it becomes more difficult, especially with children who have sensory difficulties and or oral motor deficits.
So has his little one got more? Is the cause of the dysphagia more around not having sufficient oral motor skills, which is resulting in him remaining on purees and not being able to transition onto solids?
So that would kind of depend on the child, and we would be able to kind of see that in when we evaluate the child.
Okay.
Just kind of see specifically what's going on. But there can be a link between oral motor deficits and sensory issues. So as I said before, even if you have oral motor deficits, but you are regulated, you're going to have some difficulties eating.
Mm.
However, if you are not regulated, but you have perfect or good oral motor skills, you also might likely have a feeding difficulty. So that would be, as I said, we would be able to see when we assess the child. Yeah, this is something we'd be able to kind of identify when evaluating the child, whether it's oral motor related or sensory related or both.
Yeah.
But something, you know, Dad could do at home is trying to adjust the puree consistency a little bit.
What do you mean adjust?
Making the small changes, not making it as smooth, trying to get a little bit of texture in there.
So a gradual approach.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And also just presenting new foods to the child. So this is something that research has shown that this is with all children, typically developing children as well, when presenting or trying to introduce a new food, a parent needs to present it on separate occasions at least 10 times before the child will actually accept
the food. Wow, okay. So 10 times throughout the day or 10
on
times
separate
over
occasions,
a period.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, over a period of time, and you've got to get that repeated exposure. And I think sometimes parents try like two or three times, and then they're like,
"We're in a rush to
My child doesn't like this food. We're just going to move on, to the food that they do like because we don't want a tantrum." But actually, research has shown that it takes 10 separate occasions when you need to offer this food until the child is able to accept it and tolerate it.
And would it be useful for Dad to get in touch with a speech therapist to support him through this weaning process?
Yeah, definitely. I think if it's, if it is a concern and it's causing, you know, anxiety and meal times are becoming, you know, stressful for both the child and the family, and they're really struggling to move on from purees, then mm-hmm. it would be a good idea to kind of seek professional help and advice.
Great. So I'm sure you've had this as well, Sarah, but there's always a bit of controversy surrounding my child is a picky eater, because we know that children in general are quite fussy around eating and quite picky about what they eat. You know, they don't really like vegetables or they don't really like certain fruits. How do we know when a child is a picky eater, but it's part of normal development, but actually no, that fussy eating is something to be more concerned about?
Yeah. So I think all children, or most children, go through a picky eating phase. I think
yeah.
there was definitely at times when I was a child that my mom would definitely describe me as a picky eater. I do remember there was certain foods I would not eat or try. So Dr. Kay Toomey, who developed the SOS sequential oral sensory approach program, she distinguishes between picky eaters and problem feeders. So Dr. Kate Toomey, who developed the sequential oral sensory approach, she described or distinguished between picky eaters and problem feeders. So basically picky eaters they generally have 30 foods or more, whereas problem feeders have less than 20.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I would have assumed it's the other way.
Yeah. So picky eaters are usually able to tolerate a new food. They might be a little bit hesitant, but they will be open to tolerating new food.
Okay.
Whereas problem feeders, they cannot tolerate new food. So they will have a meltdown or a tantrum. Like, it will be a very big deal, and it will be quite stressful for the family or parents who are just feeding the child.
And for a child with autism, can they be one or either? Would it be either? So they're either a picky eater or a
problem feeder.
So you can be a picky eater and a
problem feeder
with or without autism.
Yeah, exactly. So some of the other things is picky eaters, foods that are lost to burnout or a food jag, which we talked about earlier, can usually be regained over a short break, whereas problem feeders, this food is usually completely eliminated from the range of foods that they eat, or it takes a really long time to get that food back. Another one is picky eaters generally, they will eat at least one food from every food or texture group. So like proteins, fruits, vegetables, or pureed solids. So they will eat one food from at least every group. Whereas problem feeders may or generally exclude entire food group or groups or textures, food groups or textures.
Okay.
So, and that is obviously quite problematic, because that, you know, can lead, then we start worrying about nutrition and things like that.
And is it right that we can sort of see when they're turning 6 months and we're starting that weaning process that they're refusing these foods because it's part of being a fussy, picky eater?
Yeah, so I think these are things that kind of parents can look out for.
Yeah.
You know, when, as you said, as early as 6 months, when you kind of introducing more and more foods and moving on to solid foods and things like that. So these are kind of things that parents can look out for.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it becomes a real concern and its meal times become increasingly stressful, you know, then it's advisable to, you can get professional advice and help.
And other sort of symptoms to look out for, I'm just going to sort of mention a few, and please do add, continually refusing or disliking trying new foods, aversive to particular textures, tastes, or food groups. And these are the kind of things we've spoken about today.
Yeah.
Becoming more restrictive or particular with certain foods, eating one type or one brand of food. And here's the interesting question. Do children with... So with children who have got autism and who may have, who do have sensory feeding difficulties, do they drink milk okay for the first sort of 12 months? Or do you often see when you're doing the case history that actually they've had difficulties with drinking milk either via bottle or breast?
Again, that's kind of dependent on the child.
Okay.
In the clients that I've had or what I've experienced, milk hasn't been a big issue, unless there's kind of one of those cases where they have a lactose intolerance.
Of course.
The child can't tolerate dairy, then that can cause a number of other problems. But yeah, generally it's kind of dependent on the child, I guess.
And for more sort of visual, I guess, behaviours, I've sort of seen that they often have frequent colds and illnesses. So children who are fussy eaters, there's weight loss, they can often be underweight.
Exactly.
And they're tired and irritable because, of course, there's a lack of energy.
Yeah, exactly. And a few other things that you want to also look out for is kind of choking, gagging, coughing, vomiting, because these are also kind of symptoms and signs that or red flags that parents can look out for when, you know, maybe they should get some professional advice.
Okay, so you've sort of touched on the next topic, which is the vomiting. Because when I've seen children with autism, I've had parents report that they've eaten something and then they've vomited. Oh, they've just been diagnosed with gastrointestinal problems or reflux. Can you shed a bit of light around that?
Yeah, so reflux, so this kind of links to kind of reasons why children won't eat. And often that can, one of them is pain and discomfort. And this is something we see a lot in children with reflux. So what happens, when they eat and then they get reflux, it's uncomfortable, it may cause pain, and it decreases their motivation to eat because they start associating eating food or drinking with pain and discomfort.
Okay.
And then you kind of get that negative association and then you get food aversions.
Okay, so it's an organic cause, but then it sort of develops sensory feeding difficulties.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I know we touched slightly on oral motor deficits in relation to feeding difficulties. Are you able to go into a little bit more detail about that?
Sure. So children will most likely have difficulties with eating if they have poor oral motor skills because they can't or they're not able to manage or cope with certain foods, textures or consistencies.
What do you mean by poor oral motor skills? I mean, what are oral motor skills for our listeners?
So these are the skills that we use in, our tongue, our teeth, our cheeks, our lips to facilitate eating and swallowing. So how it may present is you might have reduced tongue coordination or reduced jaw strength and coordination, reduced cheek and lip strength. And all these kind of deficits or difficulties will impact on a child's eating and ability to cope with certain skills. So children will tend to refuse or avoid foods that they don't have the skill set for or to manage. So things you might see is food left over in the mouth, food falling out of the mouth because they don't have the lip closure, choking or gagging, things also like pocketing in the cheeks if they have reduced cheek strength. So those are kind of the things that you might see as a parent happening if your child has reduced oral motor skills.
So you spoke earlier on about, you informed me that you are a SOS feeding basic level one provider.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
So what is SOS feeding? I'm assuming, you know, I know a little bit about it. So it's a technique that therapists and families can then use and schools can use to help improve feeding skills.
Exactly.
And swallowing in general.
Yeah. So it stands for, I think I've said it before, sequential oral sensory approach. And this was developed by Dr. Kay Toomey.
Okay. Is that in the UK?
In America.
Okay.
Yeah. And she is basically, she's a psychologist with over 30 years of experience in working with children with feeding difficulties. And she developed this amazing approach. And basically, it integrates motor, oral, behavior, learned, medical, sensory, and nutritional factors to evaluate and manage children with feeding difficulties. And it follows the typical developmental steps, stages, and skills of feeding. And it basically helps children to learn about their senses and learn about food. And it aims to increase the child's comfort level by exploring and learning about the different properties of food.
And so to provide this type of therapy, you need to have gone on the training.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they have different levels of training.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to, you know, carry out this approach, you would need to go on the training. And it's basically just a playful and positive approach. And it's really had it's had amazing success. So, yeah.
And is that purely for sensory feeding difficulties, or could it also be for difficulties that are organic in nature, mixture?
Yeah, so it's a holistic approach. So it looks at the child as a whole. So you're not just looking at sensory difficulties. You're kind of looking at everything. So, the organ systems, the muscles, the development, the sensory aspect, their oral motor skills, their learning and behavior, nutrition, and the environment in which they eat in. So, yeah.
And like you said earlier on, it's got a good success rate. So this is something that you've used and that you do use to treat and to manage.
Yeah, exactly. Children with picky eaters or problem feeders. That's kind of why the approach was developed.
Brilliant.
Where
can people get more information about it?
So they have a fantastic website, which is sosapproachtofeeding.com. And they have resources for parents, information for parents. There's also a referral list. So if you need to find a SOS trained therapist in your area, you can look that up and it will give you a list of all the therapists in that area.
Okay.
And as I said, there's lots of information that parents can have a look at.
And again, this is just, you know, sort of one approach. There are many approaches out there that people in schools and parents can use to support their child with the process. Okay, so if you are a parent concerned about your child's food selectivity, food or texture refusal, mealtime tantrums, reduced food or liquid intake, or swallowing, your child may benefit from feeding therapy. Feeding therapy is used to help infants and children who have difficulties sucking, chewing, feeding, or swallowing. And the earlier a child is in therapy to assess these problems, the better their growth, nutrition, and future eating outcomes. And so that's where the speech and language therapist comes in, sometimes in combination with an occupational therapist or a trained medical professional that can help with feeding and swallowing therapy. So Sarah, can we explain what is feeding therapy?
So feeding therapy is basically just helping the child and the family manage feeding difficulties that the child may present with. So this might be sensory difficulties, oral motor deficits, more organic problems, you know, actual difficulties with the swallowing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just and also kind of helping the child accept new foods, you know, introduce new foods and increasing the range of the foods that they eat. So it's quite a broad term, but basically maybe some things that we can talk about now is the kind of techniques and strategies that parents could use at home.
Part of your feeding therapy.
Exactly, because, you know, when a child has feeding difficulties, it does cause a lot of anxiety and stress, and it can be, meal times can be particularly stressful. So I've kind of already mentioned exposure and repetition, and that we want to present new foods at least 10 times to kind of help the child accept that new food.
Yeah.
Another thing that's important to kind of look into at home is the cues to eating. So, you know, who, what, where, when. So who's feeding the child, you know, what are we feeding the child? Are there utensils involved? You know, where's the feeding happening? Is it at, you know, a table? Is it they're sitting on a chair? Or is it on the floor? Things like that. And looking at what we can change, what cues we can change within that. So it might just be changing the environment that the child eats in, maybe.
So an environment that's...
Yeah, that maybe has, you know, little distractions. Maybe it's introducing or changing the utensils that you're using. So you can make small changes at home.
Okay.
That can help the child. Also, another thing is looking at seating and posture. So we want the child in a nice upright position, and we want them to be supported. So if the child has low muscle tone and they're kind of holding themselves up and they're focusing on their posture, and we need them to focus more on the food. So if we can provide that support for them.
And that's really by using a chair.
Exactly.
Because I've sometimes gone in to see children at home and they're sort of sitting on the settee or running around, and they're a fussy eater. So it's really difficult to try and get anything for them. It's really difficult to get them to eat anything.
Exactly. So the general kind of rule that, you know, parents can use is 90 degrees. The hips need to be at 90 degrees, the knees need to be at 90 degrees, and the ankles need to be at 90 degrees.
Okay.
So you kind of want that foot support as well.
And that just gives sort of general stability.
In the posture, which then can help them actually focus on eating and the food that's in front of them. Another tip is just to try and make meal times, or even, it doesn't even have to be at meal times, but kind of you want to create those positive associations with food. So you want to make it playful, you want to make it fun, you want to make it positive.
But I mean, in reality, it's hard to do, because as a parent, you just kind of want to get through mealtime, because
exactly.
Feeding your child is a hard task.
Yeah. So sometimes it's not always about the actual mealtime. So a great way to learn about food is maybe trying to include the child in meal preparation, because you can talk about what you're doing to the food, you're changing the food, you can talk about the properties of the food, and it's interactive. They can get involved and can, you know, be quite fun mixing something, or you know, helping chopping things or things like that. So meal prep is a great way to include the child and to help them learn about food and how we make it. Another one is we want to be kind of the models for the child. So we always want them to have them at the table with us at the meal time. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to eat the same foods as us, doesn't mean that they have to eat. But we know that children learn through imitation.
Yeah.
So watching others, and if we can model, you know, good eating and things like that, and they can watch, even if they really aren't eating themselves, that's absolutely fine. But we're giving them those opportunities to watch others eating food and interacting with food. Another important one is structure. So we want to create structure throughout the day. So have, you know, specific times that meals take place. So that can be, you know, breakfast, snack time, lunch. So another important one is structure. And this is basically having a schedule and set times for meals and snack times. And this helps children to get ready for the next meal, and it helps also helps with appetite. And then they kind of know what to expect as well. And this is also really important for children with autism, because, you know, we know that they like routine and structure.
Yeah.
So structure is really important, to have those set meal times throughout the day where children, you know, will eat. So,
well, I went to see a client once, and mum had a really good routine set in trying to introduce new foods. And she sort of used a gradual approach, introducing new foods in small increments. So on Monday it would be smelling the food. On Tuesday it might be placing the food near the lips. On Wednesday it's licking the food. On Thursday it's holding a bite of food in the mouth. So kind of like a gradual approach to a food, but the same food, but over the week.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite a useful way of going about it. And
so that's kind of with the SOS approach, when I was speaking about following typical developmental steps and stages, is they have developed steps to eating. So the first step is tolerating food, and then it is interacting with the food, and then smelling the food, and then tasting the food, and then eventually chewing and swallowing the food. So a gradual approach is, you know, what we'll also do in therapy, and what parents can focus on at home is kind of working through those steps to increase the comfort level of the child. So I talked about meal prep earlier, which is a great way to kind of learn about foods
together.
As well as introduce new foods. So obviously we want to expand the range of foods that the child eats, especially when there is that selectivity or restricted intake of certain foods. So I think one thing we need to, as stressful as meal times can be, we don't want to force the child to eat anything, or we don't want to like expect them to eat anything. We just want to create that positive environment with food. And sometimes we just need to start, you know, at the first step, and that's just interacting with foods.
Okay.
So if the child is able to tolerate, you know, the foods in front of them, you know, we want to touch them, feel them, talk about, you know, include all our senses, what they feel like, what they smell like, maybe what they taste like, if the child's willing to taste the food. So we want to teach them that they don't need to be afraid of these new foods, and just make it very fun and playful, and using kind of exploring all of our senses, and slowly kind of working our way up to the mouth to eventually swallow, chewing and swallowing. So again, talking about that graded approach that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And what can parents expect when they do a referral to a speech therapist? So they refer to speech therapy, they're going to have an assessment. Does the assessment normally take place at the clinic or at the home?
Both. So I think that also depends what parents, you know, would like. If some parents would like you to come to the home, and some parents will come to the, are happy to come to the clinic. So it's kind of just preferences and what works best for the client. So in terms of a feeding assessment, we're going to definitely be, there's definitely food going to be involved.
Yes.
So I think we want to kind of look at our motor skills. We want to look for any sensory difficulties. We want to look for any postural instability. We want to look at swallow safety. You know, are they swallowing safely? There's no coughing or things like that.
And if they are coughing, what does that mean?
So that's probably more linked to our organic swallowing difficulties.
Okay.
And something that we would then need to investigate further. You know, because there might be things like aspiration.
Going down the wrong way.
Exactly, going into our lungs instead of into our stomachs. So that would then require further investigation. But I think it's also about identifying, you know, what foods can the child eat? What are the foods that they're refusing? So their preferred and non-preferred foods. And then, you know, discussing, you know, with the parents about how they're eating at home. So I think a lot of the time it's also observing whoever feeds the child, feeding the child, to kind of see how they're feeding the child, what they're feeding the child, what are they using to feed the child. So it's really looking at the whole picture and also the environment that they're feeding in. Is the TV on in the background? Things like that. And then I think it's just about, you know, discussing the parents' concerns and coming up with a plan going forward and giving, you know, discussing what they can do at home and explaining what we'll be doing in therapy. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Sarah, for coming on the show. I've often had parents asking me lots of questions around, you know, my child is a fussy eater, or I've noticed, you know, my child's not been eating well for the last few months and they've got a diagnosis of autism. So it's good to get sort of more detailed information about what parents can do if their child has got a diagnosis of autism along with sensory feeding difficulties. So any last parting words for our listeners?
Yes. I think it can be, you know, feeding difficulties can be quite complicated and stressful, especially when it's, you know, with autism-related feeding difficulties. And I think parents worry a lot, which, you know, of course, it's to do with eating, and that's such a big part of, you know, of a child's life.
Yeah, exactly, daily routine.
Exactly. And just when a child's not eating or not eating well, you know, parents are going to be concerned. It's really stressful. So I think if you are struggling at home, we are here to help. So reach out and, you know, try some of the techniques and strategies that we've talked about today. And definitely, if you feel like it's an ongoing problem and it's really persisting, then definitely seek out professional advice and we can definitely help you.
And really, even if it's not being persistent and it's the start of it, and you're, you know, as you discuss sort of the red flags to look out for,
exactly,
you know, contact your GP and refer to speech therapist, and you're seen quite quickly because it's a swallowing related issue.
Exactly.
So it's seen quite quickly on the NHS and in private clinics.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for coming on the show, and that's been great, and I look forward to having you on the show again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun.
So if you'd like to get in touch with Sarah, you can email her on sarah-lee@unlockinglanguage.co.uk. If you'd like any particular topics covered around speech and language therapy or around autism, please do email me. You can contact me on social media. My Instagram is shamina_rabi, or you can add me on Twitter, which is @ulspeechtherapy. Or you can get in touch with me via email info@unlockinglanguage.co.uk. Hope you all have a great week. Speak to you next week.